we invite Giacomo Terreran, who will talk about very late time observations of stripped envelope supernovae and evidences for the presence of a pulsar wind nebula.
Yes. Well, while it's uploading, I will thank you, the organizer, for giving me the opportunity to talk to you guys. And as soon as the presentation comes back, I will talk to you about late time observation of superenvelope supernova, mainly optical observations, but also radio and X-ray. Don't know jokes to entertain you, unfortunately. Here we go. Okay. So I wanted to start by introducing Raffaella Margutti's group at Sierra Northwestern. So you can see Raffaella's up here. She will join us later this week, and you're going to hear from her on Friday, I think. And right now, this time, there's going to be three of us getting our hands dirty with data. These are Diane Copians here, that's me, and there's a Prajita. Plus, we have two graduate students and three undergrads that will have, they will get their hands dirty pretty much soon. And these are just some of our collaborators that usually work with us. There's Kate Alexander, also at Northwestern. Then Regis Carter, it's our observer at SOAR in Chile. Dan, Ryan, Chornock, then Patnaud and Damiano, who's also joining us later. The way it works in Raffaella's group is that every one of us has a specific area of electromagnetic spectrum in which we have our expertise. So for example, Diane is expert in radio, I'm the optical guy, and Aparajita is getting better and better with X-rays, while Raffaella basically oversee everything. And so one result of this synergy, this collaboration of all the electromagnetic spectrum is a work that I recently submitted about 16COI, which you can see here. We get a lot of data from this guy, as you can see, as the many spectrum here that didn't fit in just one figure. And so the classification at the beginning wasn't so easy, so we used the templates provided by Mariam Mojats. And you see that we can see several similarities between a normal 1C and a broad line 1C. Actually, with the new schema, would be really interesting to see where it falls. And even more interesting, I think, it shows helium at very early stages, and then it disappeared. And so looking at the broad light curve here, you see that compared to other superenvelope supernova, this is a sample published by Lyman et al. In 2016, it has a pretty broad light curve. So broad light curves means longer diffusion time, which if you assume like an average energy means a lot of mass. And when we do the modeling of this light curve, we get a 4 to 7 solar mass ejecta, which is pretty high for a stripped envelope supernova, as you assume that they have lost all their hydrogen and helium by the time of explosion. And so I talked about synergy, about radio, X-ray, and optical, and we observed this guy also in the X-ray and the radio. The X-ray emission is well reproduced with an inverse Compton model, and radio is pretty standard self-absorption synchrotron emission. And so the result of this analysis is that the progenitor of COI, 16 COI, was surrounded by a pretty well-behaved wind, which was put there with a mass loss of 3 to 7 times 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year. This is like a fairly high mass loss and is compatible with the wind of a Warfarin star. Moreover, if you look, I don't have the slide here, but if you look at the steepness of the density gradient that we can infer from the radio modeling, it's also consistent with a compact progenitor. Again, Warfarin is working as a progenitor. And if you're not still convinced, we can have a look at the nebular phases, the nebular spectra, which can give you further constraint on the mass of the progenitor, as the relative abundances of elements depends on the core mass, and in particular, the models by Franson and Chevalier from 89 showed a correlation between the ratio of forbidden calcium and forbidden oxygen with the core mass of the progenitor. Here, I put, you see COI on the top, the oxygen is this strong line in the middle, and the calcium is the other line here. And you can see there is quite a variety of different ratio that we can infer, going this is like a 1C, and then we have a 2B, a broad line. And so we collect all late time observation, and we have a look at this relation here, which you can see in the second picture here. So the correlation is between, so there are a lot of caveats to be said about this correlation. But at zero order, you can assume that the lower the ratio of the calcium over oxygen is, the more massive is the core. And so you see here that, for example, COI with a very late spectroscopy, we can infer a pretty massive progenitor. It's really hard to give you a number, but like it's what is this plot, well, the giveaway point of this plot is that it's probably one of the most massive among all the sample analyzed here. So with radio and X-ray and late time observation of this COI, we were able to have, I think, a pretty thorough idea of what happened to the progenitor of 16 COI. And so recently at Northwestern, we purchased time at Keck and MMT, and so we decided to push our optical follow-up even further. One example of this is the spectra we took of 14 HLS. This is not a stupid envelope supernova, it's just a little bit detour. But so if you're not familiar, this was defined as the impossible supernova because it was a it showed a 600 days long plateau with a lot of wiggles and almost no evolution whatsoever spectroscopically in this lapse of time. Eventually, finally, this evolved, and the first spectra were published by Andrews and Smith last year. And you see that the hydrogen had this double profile, this two double profile. And so we took several spectra. I show you just the first 2 years, and you're going to see the next one in forthcoming papers. And there might be also an evolution of these two broad features component H-alpha. The explanation of this impossible supernova was actually suggested by Andrews, was that when we started actually taking the spectra, the photosphere was outside and had already engulfed a thick disk that was surrounding the progenitor star. With time, the photosphere receded, and then now the photosphere was inside the disk, we actually see the presence of the disk in the spectra. But coming back to stupid envelope supernova, actually I'm talking about a superluminous supernova. This is 15 BN. This is one of Matt Nichols' obsession. He published 3 papers already that I know of. And so we had very late time observation with HST and Magellan. And you can see these data point here are over 1,000 days after explosion. And so in a supernova, in lack of additional powering source, you're expected a late time to follow the cobble decay here. And you can definitely see that we have a flattening of the light curve here at late times. You can explain that you are required to have an additional powering source. Talking about superluminous supernova, definitely interaction and magnetars are the one that you can have in your mind. Interaction, there are no strong, I haven't put like previous spectra, but from the spectroscopy, there are no strong evidence for interaction. And so a magneton remains. And if you take the slope of this decay, it's actually t to the minus 4, which is also compatible with the presence of a magneton. Moreover, the spectra didn't evolve at all. Well, it evolved a little bit, but you can still see the same oxygen line and calcium line that you can see 700 days before. And these are interpreted as to be ionized by the wind of the magneton within inside the explosion. And so we're talking about superluminous supernova. Talking about magneton for these guys is not exotic anymore, right? It's not that it's accepted, but at least that we talk about it is accepted. But what if we see the same thing also in a normal 1C supernova? So this is 15 DTG published this year by Francesco Taddia. And we see a similar thing here, right? We see a flattening of the light curve, and then we still see this oxygen and calcium line. And in 15 DTG, we also saw other lines of oxygen at a longer wavelength. And so also for this guy, there is no strong evidence for interaction. In red here, you see 10 MB, which was probably powered by interaction. And you see here that this has a blue a blue excess that we don't see in all the other more normal, more traditional 1C supernova. And so also in this case, we can possibly say that the actual ionization that we see here is provoked by the neutron star pulsar wind that is coming from the inside. And then we can have a look at 12AP. This is another one, supernova, but the object that I showed you before were from 15. This is actually from 12. This is 7 years now, year old, and we still see detection from it. So I don't have a light curve, but you can understand that it's not following nickel decay after this time. And even here, we see all the oxygen lines, and there is no strong evidence for interaction here either. So you need an extra source of power. You don't have the nickel, because nickel cannot sustain this luminosity at this late time. And so there remains just one other thing, the fact that there is inside the presence, the neutron star inside is starting to blow a bubble that is actually pushing and ionizing, shocking the inner part of the ejecta. And we see the oxygen, which is actually the element that you expect to see in the inner part. And so all the objects that I showed you did not have any detection in the X-ray or in the radio. If there's a pulsar wind nebula coming up, there must be some leakage of photons, so we could possibly see them in this wavelength. And so that's what we are trying to do also. We try to look at radio and X-ray late time observation. We try to rediscover basically in radio and X-ray very old supernova. And we actually have pretty nice light curve of over 1,000 days old of all these objects and actually a bunch of more. We were able to find them also in the optical, at least two of them. In particular, we found O3GK. And it's actually almost a twin of 12AU, although this is 03, we are in 19, so this is 16 years old, so it's 5,600 days spectrum. And we still see the oxygen lines like on all the one before. If we see it, it's definitely not coming from Nico. And one prediction that Dan Milisaljevich did for 12AU was that if the emission is powered by a pulsar wind nebula, then the bubble is expanding and is accelerating the inner part of the inner part of the ejecta. So you would see an acceleration of the oxygen. And this is the comparison between 12AP oxygen altogether and O3GK oxygen altogether. And these are two completely different objects. You want to see such an evolution on the same object. But actually, the fact that the oxygen that we see in O3GK is faster than 12AP, maybe I want to claim that is a suggestion that the bubble has pushed for quite a while now, and we see accelerated ejecta. We have a couple of problems for O3GK. We have detection in the X-ray. We have detection in the radio. I think Dan Patno showed the X-ray. And We cannot exclude interaction for 3GK. First of all, we saw a lot of narrow lines that I took out here, but there are narrow lines coming up. I took them out because you can see here that O3GK is in a very dense environment. You can definitely see strong lines coming from an H2 region below it. And the subtraction that I made seems to take them away. So I'm more tended to say that all the narrow lines are not coming from interaction. But another issue is the other objects didn't show H-alpha. This is H-alpha. H-alpha is, a broad H-alpha is something that we see when there is interaction. And so we will have to crank a little bit more on the numbers, on the X-ray especially, and the radio to see if we can confirm the Pulsar-Wind Nebula theory. And even this is a nice image that I found. And we can see the supernova in Sloan, in SDSS. This is SDSS minus Pan-STAR. This is not something, some observation that we did. We just took the two different catalog and we made a subtraction and we found a trace. This is probably a signal to noise of 8. And I think I'm concluding now. Yes. So my conclusion are pretty straightforward. I think it's not me that telling you that late time supernova observation of supernova are extremely useful, and it's not me that I'm telling you that radio and X-ray altogether are actually giving us the bigger picture. But I think that this is like a new way to actually see the pulsar coming up. Like, we haven't seen the pulsar or the black hole of 87A yet. Maybe this, if we can happy with an indirect proof of the presence of the pulsar inside this object, I think I would be extremely happy anyway. And I want to conclude with actually an advertisement of a meeting that we are having in Evanston later this year. Registration. This is the sixth event of the hot wiring series of meetings, and registration are due pretty soon. So please see you in Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Okay.
Maria. Very nice work. I had a question, lots of questions. One is about O2AP. So
yes.
The late time spectrum was really beautiful. So you mentioned there's no sign of interaction, but I saw lots of high ionization oxygen lines that might indicate that it's in hydrogen-free interaction. So can you comment on that, please?
You're talking about interaction and the presence of oxygen. So I think it's more of the idea is that the back shock is actually coming in from, like, there's probably a region of, the ejecta is clashing with a CSM outside. And what we're seeing is actually the back shock traveling now in the inner part of the ejecta. We don't have like a series of spectra. Maybe if it's interaction going on, maybe if we had spectra before, we could have seen like a transition of elements. That's my interpretation.
So my second question is, I mean, late time observations are really great and important, as you showed, because things change. Your work, Danny Milosalovic, Rafaela's work have shown. So I was wondering, for your criteria to look at late times, do you have a certain criterion of like a volume limited survey so that we can get a full picture and do rates? Because I mean, that's a big question, is how do you remove the outer layers? That's one question.
True.
And also, what's the compact object that's left behind?
So this survey, if I'm not wrong, was actually to look for offset jets. Mm-hmm. And so looking for something, you actually find something else. So this is not probably a satisfactory answer. But what we are doing now is actually trying to go after them in X-ray and radio first, and then go look for them in the optical.
We can chat about that. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, quick question. What do you mean by a magnetar? So for somebody who studies neutron stars, I think of a magnetar as isolated neutron star, very strong magnetic field, radiation powered by magnetic field decay.
Yes.
This is something different. So exactly
yes.
What do you mean?
So I don't need a magnetar for O3GK, for example, or the other ones. A magnetar is always invoked for superluminous supernovae, and I also study magnetar as a grad student, and I know that there is a difference between the two nomenclatures.
Well, I guess what properties are you talking about? So is this a neutron star, very short spin-down time scale, high initial spin-down luminosity, or is it something else?
So just for the first one, the 15BN, the superluminous supernova, when we talk about magnetar and superluminous supernova, it's the highly magnetized neutron star with short time, with short spin period. That's what we require. And I think it's just, I agree that there is like some misconception between like what we observe as a magnetar and what we call magnetar inside the superluminous supernova.
Question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.